unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. So good morning, everybody. I enjoyed Tim's talk yesterday. I guess you did too. I especially appreciated his telling us about his family history and about the gathering with the Lummi people. When we're at Samish, we can see from Samish, Lummi Island. And, you know, it was very profound to think about the truth that we're all the time living in the past, present, and future. It's easy to forget history on purpose or not on purpose. But history is actually what's happening now. In every moment of our lives, history is happening. And with every moment of our lives, with every word, with every action, whether we know it or not, we are expressing the past. And we are providing for the future. So it's really good to, these days, learn more about what our history has actually been so that we can take it into account for the present and for the future. You know, taking responsibility for all that is the first step in Dharma practice, realizing, you know, how momentous our actions are and how essential it is that we take care of them. Tim also mentioned in his talk yesterday that we had a little, you know, 2-second discussion about Tim and Chris and I about what were we going to have as a theme for the Dharma talks. And we all agreed, well, let's do koans. And so far, we haven't heard koan number one. But until now, so today I bring up a Zen story. And this one is from The Hidden Lamp, which I'm sure many of you know this book. It's a great collection of Dharma stories about women compiled by our own Sangha members, Florence Kaplow and Sue Moon. So I'm going to share a story from that collection, the story of the seven wise women in the charnel ground. So here's the story as it appears on page 44 of their text. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. One of them said, "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." And the other said, "Well, that's a place of decaying corpses. What is such a place good for?" And the first woman replied, "Let's just go. Very good things are there." When they arrived, one of them pointed to a corpse and said, "There is a person's body. But where has the person gone?" "What?" another one said. "What did you say?" And all seven sisters were immediately awakened. Indra, Lord of the gods, was moved by their awakening and showered flowers down on them. He offered them whatever they needed for the rest of their lives. And one of them said, "We have everything we need. But please give us a tree without roots, some land without light or shade, and a mountain valley where a shout does not echo. Ask for anything else, holy ladies," replied Indra, "and I will gladly provide it, but I don't have those things to give you." "If you don't have them," said the women, "how can you help others liberate themselves?" At this, Indra took the sisters to visit the Buddha. When the Buddha learned why they had come, he said, "As far as that's concerned, Indra, none of the arhats has the slightest clue either. Only great bodhisattvas understand this matter." And that's our story. When it says in the beginning, planning a spring journey, we went on a spring journey to Brooklyn. And we were with our grandchildren in the botanical gardens in Brooklyn about midway through the cherry blossom season. And they have a big sort of separate park in there, where there are cherry blossoms on either side. And they were all blooming. And also the ground was covered with spent cherry blossoms. And the lilacs were in bloom. And it was really, really beautiful. It was spring. In the eastern part of the country is very beautiful. But these women decided to celebrate spring by going to a charnel ground. Why did they do that? One of the features of Sue and Florence's book, which I really admire them for doing this, is they asked Zen women from around the country and around the world to comment on each one of these stories. When I think of the nightmare of communicating with all these different people, you know, and getting all the stories and keeping them straight, I get a headache just thinking about it. But they did this. And here's, I'll read you a little part of the commentary to this story written by Bonnie Myotai Tracy, who is in the lineage of Maizumi Roshi and Daido Luri Roshi in the Zen Mountains Center in New York. "There is much to love and study in this story and many ways to appreciate it," she writes. "But I don't want to overlook the simple picture. A group of women freely discerning how best to use their time and taking some time to be together alone. So one of the first teachings here is the quiet reminder that women may need some time to walk with one another as these women do, literally, amid the burning. It is much harder to maintain the walk of awareness without other women. Receiving the legacy of our grandmothers and mothers helps us. So does knowing that our sisters are beside us and recognizing that we are here to make a better world for our daughters and granddaughters. But the story of the wise women also reminds us that facing what needs to be faced, walking toward the charnel grounds, can strike us as basically unpleasant. Aren't there always sweeter ways to spend a day, if one has the option, than in the contemplation of death and impermanence? But the lead woman cuts through. "Sisters, just go. Very good things are there. As we take the step off the edge, here is a reminder to trust the perfect air. Our wise women gently turn aversion on its head. The place where release from the suffering of decay will be realized might just be exactly where we least expect to find it. This story reminds me of another story about the 16 bodhisattvas in the bath. They all awaken at the same time when their skins touch the warm water. Most of the awakening stories, you know, are about a person who awakens, and these two stories are about a bunch of people awakening together. In the bodhisattvas in the bath, they awaken together to a true appreciation of what this sensory world is. And in the case of the seven women, they awaken by turning toward what seems scary and unpleasant, and suddenly realizing the awesome beauty of impermanence. So, you know, as Tim mentioned, you know, the story of the Buddha is the heroic story that probably maps exactly onto many other traditional tales of heroic quest. But as Myotai says, when she talks about the need for women to walk together and be together, and as we also know from our own experience in practice, we don't really awaken alone. We really always, even when it looks like alone, we're awakening together. Because awakening is not something that belongs to me or belongs to you. It's not an achievement of my understanding or your understanding or the power of my practice or the power of your practice. It's something that arises between us. As Dogen so beautifully says, quoting a line in the Lotus Sutra, only a Buddha and a Buddha can understand. So when we think of the world and all of its suffering, we can take heart to remember that we awaken in the world and with the world, that we are all on the path of awakening to fairness and justice and goodness and loving kindness for everyone. And that's our awakening. And that's what we have been doing these days of our session. Even though we're all in our separate places, we have been walking quietly together amid the burning. So we might understand impermanence, as I was saying the other day, I think we all commonly understand it this way when you analyze, what do I think impermanence is? We think it sort of means here today, gone tomorrow. You know, we have our friend and then we lose our friend. We have our life and then we lose our life. And yes, we're human, so we feel that sense of loss and that grief, which sometimes is quite searing. Many of us in the Sangha have felt it. And it might be deep, it might be long lasting. So for sure, that's an element of impermanence that we have to, or an aspect of impermanence that we have to digest and dissolve, and it's very powerful. But I think the women in this story are also showing us something else. I think it's important that the story says it's springtime, the time when life is springing back and everything is in bloom. And the trees that have been bare all winter long are just beginning to bud and leaf out, and everything is fresh and new. And you forget all about winter. And you think about the new life. But where does spring come from? It comes from winter, just as winter comes from spring. One side of impermanence is that it's loss. But also, impermanence is not loss. Impermanence is change, transformation, the ongoingness of spring, summer, winter, fall, round and round. So one of the women already knows this and wants to show this to her sisters. So let's go to the charnel ground. Very good things are there. I can remember still quite vividly a long time ago when my mother died. It was the fall of the year, and I was with her, and everyone else was gone, and I sat with her body, and I looked out down below. You know, it was a high floor in the hospital, and so I looked down below at the big expanse of green grass on the hospital grounds. I don't think I ever saw grass that green before or since. There was a man down below, I remember, slowly going up and down, riding his mower. Silently, you know, behind the double pane window. And later, after I got used to her being gone, I thought to myself, well, my whole life, pretty much, my mother lived far away from me. So most of the time, I didn't see my mother. She was absent. And now that she's dead, I still don't see my mother. So what's the difference between the absence I felt when she was alive and the absence I feel now that she's gone? Is there any difference? Was it just the idea that it was different? I still haven't figured that out. The Dharma teaches us that actual presence, true presence, is more and less than it seems to be. We chant every day, all dharmas are empty. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. We're here and we're not here. That's real presence. We can never grasp it. It's too awesome for our eyes to see and our ears to hear. And yet, we're seeing it and hearing it all the time, in, around, between, and underneath everything we're seeing and hearing. Being alive is being off balance all the time. Against the background of eternity, falling all the time into eternity, and then getting back up again into time. Only we don't know we're doing this. Once in a while, we have the feeling of it. And anyway, as we continue to practice and live our lives, going through the many changes that come with being a child, being young, then a little older, and still a little more older, and a little more older, and then maybe pretty old, seeing all the changes that have happened in our lives and in the world around us, we begin to appreciate this truth more and more, that we've been always, always falling and getting up again, falling and getting up again against the background of eternity. That's there all the time. So that's how it is. Maybe these days of long and slow breathing, you can almost feel it. Certainly, one way to feel it is, as in this story, to directly contemplate death. Right here, in front of these women, is a corpse. It's a person's body, but where's the person? Where did she go? Maybe if you have attended a death, you have experienced just this thing. The person, however weak or close to death they may seem, is still there. Completely there, completely a person. And then, in a moment that may be starkly identifiable or maybe so gradual it's you're not even sure, there's no one there. What just happened? What? What happened? You can't say. And yet you feel it. Maybe you can also feel it these days in your breathing. You exhale a long, slow exhale that gets slower and finer and more subtle. And then what? Does it end? And before you can even formulate such a question, gathers the inhale, and life comes back. And this goes on breath after breath. And we say, we're alive. That's what happens in our story, that the women all together, inspired by one another and supporting one another, find this truth of impermanence. The story says, as is the convention in Zen stories, and they were enlightened. But what that really means is they found within their hearts, at the bottom of their hearts, this truth of impermanence, this beauty, this tragedy of our being human together. But as we see, the story doesn't end with awakening, it goes on after that. Indra, the king of the gods, is really happy that this has happened to these women, and he's really enthusiastic about it. And he starts hurling flowers from the sky, flowers rain down on them. And he says to them, "I'm so impressed with what you have realized, and I'm God, so I'll give you anything you want." Somehow, sometimes I think maybe this is how we think of awakening. You know, we like children, you know, we think, oh, you know, when I get awakened, I'll be really happy and I'll get everything I ever wanted. Seems ridiculous, but maybe we're thinking like that. But here these women say, no, we already have everything we want. Thank you anyway. But how about give us A rootless tree, a shadowless land, an echoless valley. Of course, there's no such thing as a rootless tree, a shadowless land, an echo-free valley. It's kind of like a Catholic rabbi or a chicken with lips. You can say it, but how can it exist? Or anyway, it seems that way. So Indra, who's the master of things that can be given, can't give these things. He's completely stumped. So he takes the sisters to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "Well, Indra, this is not only beyond your understanding, it's also beyond the understanding of the awakened arhats. Only bodhisattvas can appreciate this. Because bodhisattvas, unlike the arhats, have not transcended impermanence. They have thrown themselves into it. They have embraced it fully. And they have appreciated the precious human life with all of its joys and sorrows. And they know that they have whatever they have could ever want, and they've also lost whatever they could ever want. And this whole world is already awakened." I'm grateful that in their back matter at the end of the book, Florence and Sue give us the where these stories all come from. So they tell us there that this story is also mentioned in the Book of Serenity. It's not the main case, but it's a commentary to one of the main cases, case 14 in the Book of Serenity. So I'll read you the case in the Book of Serenity, which is, as you know, a classic, one of the three major classics of collections of Zen stories. So here's the 14th of the 100 stories of Book of Serenity. Attendant Huo asked Deshan, "Where have all the sages since antiquity gone?" And Deshan said, "What? What? What do you say? How's that?" And Huo said, "The order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise shows up." Deshan let it rest. The next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Huo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Huo on the back, and Huo said, "This old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse." Again, Deshan let the matter rest. So it's interesting to think about the way that our original story is used in this case. In a way, the main point of the story is identical to the story of the seven women. In fact, when Deshan says, "What? What? How's that?" it's just the same as the women who also say, "What? What? What did you say?" when they contemplate the corpse. In other words, it's an expression of wonderment, of the ineffable, baffling, ungraspable nature of permanence, impermanence, this life as it really is. Deshan is just quoting the women and referring to the earlier story as the commentary mentions. The only difference is that in the original story, the women are actually standing in front of a corpse. And in this story, Deshan is referring to the ancient masters who are long dead and gone. But are they dead and gone? Is the point. Just like my mother, I mentioned. I don't know, it's more 30, 40 years, I don't know how long since she's passed. But has she passed? Not really. I can tell you my mother is still very vividly alive in me and all around me. She didn't go anywhere. It was very poignant, actually, sometime before her death when I was visiting her. She said to me, so in a very casual way, just a matter of idle curiosity. So what do Buddhists say about what happens after you die? Now, my mother had cancer, and it was pretty clear that she was going to die from this cancer, which everybody pretty much knew, and maybe she knew, but it was not something that you would discuss with her. She never mentioned that concept that she might die. She was sick, you know, but not that she would die. So when she asked me this, the idea was, it's not personal, but just I'm curious. What do you think? What do Buddhists think about this? So I said, well, I'm not sure, but it probably depends on, who you think is dying. If you think that you are your body and all the memories and associations and thoughts that depend on that body for their existence, then yeah, probably death is the end. But if you mean all of that and your truer self, your spiritual self, your self beyond all of that, your real nature as a sacred living human being, then since that was never in your grasp anyway, you can never lose it. It doesn't ever go away. And as I was saying the other day, I miss Mel, and I don't miss Mel because he's gone, and also not. Just when we practice now, Mel is there. Suzuki Roshi is there. Dogen is there. You and I are there. We're all here. What? What? What is this? But when you think about the case in the Book of Serenity, it goes on to talk about other things, doesn't it? And what does it emphasize? Really, what it's emphasizing is the characteristics, the personalities of Deshan and his attendant Huo. And it's emphasizing their interaction. Most Zen stories do that, actually. The truth arises, but it arises in the context of our interactions, in the context of our personalities, of our karmic lives. That's how we bring up the truth together. If we weren't here being the strange, unique, odd characters that we are, we would never be able to bring up the truth. So, in the title essay of my new book, When You Greet Me, I Bow, I tell the story of Long Tan, who was Deshan's teacher. And it's Long Tan who says, "When you greet me, I bow," because the students are complaining to him, like, "How come?" His student is complaining, "How come you never teach me anything?" And Long Tan says, "What do you mean? I'm teaching you all the time. When you greet me, I bow. When you serve tea, I drink. What are you talking about? I'm teaching you all the time." So that was Deshan's teacher. And when Deshan met Long Tan, Deshan at that time was a major expert on Buddhism. He was a scholar priest, and he traveled always with his big stack of sutras. But he didn't really understand the great matter of birth and death. as it says on the han that we strike. Birth and death is the great matter. Don't waste time. In other words, Deshan knew a lot of stuff, probably understood Buddhism a lot, but he didn't know the one point that's really worth knowing. So one night when it was very dark, Long Tan lit a lamp for Deshan, and then he immediately blew it out. And then, in total darkness, Deshan saw the light. After that, he threw away all of his sutras and all the things he was expert in, and he became one of the most famous shouting and hitting Zen masters in history. Just as before, he was now, before he was all about the sutras, now he was completely intolerant of any kind of knowledge, any kind of explanation. And he was insisting on just the sensation of being alive in this moment as it is, with nothing extra at all, which made him a little scary. But then later on, like in this story, he became an old man. And he was like a pussycat. The stories about him as an old man are all just like this one. So this story really is about how to be young and how to be old and how to be gentle with one another. And how sometimes the best way you can help somebody is to allow them to be themselves without trying to change them or help them in any way at all. So in the story, poor old Deshan is insulted, you know, by his vigorous and confident student. This former tough guy is now reduced to, as we get reduced in old age, body and mind not working so well. He doesn't have the energy to hit him. And maybe sometimes, you know, younger people look at us and they think, poor guy, too bad he's losing it. The young are always arrogant that way, aren't they? Which we know very well because we were young at one time. And that's how we felt about our elders. But Deshan is too old and too wise to be insulted. Far from being resentful, he pats Huo affectionately on the back. Maybe he appreciates his vigor and his pride, even if it seems to be at his expense. Even though he knows that Huo is foolish, he doesn't need to say so. And maybe he doesn't even think so. Another place this story appears is in one of Dogen's Dharma discourses, which appears in the Ehe Koroku, volume one, discourse number 64. And in that discourse, Dogen tells the story, repeats the story, more or less the same. You know, whenever you read a different version of the story, some of the details are always different. And maybe it makes the story a little different. But more or less, Dogen tells the same story, so I won't repeat it. But here is his comment that he makes at the end of the story. The great Shravakas, arhats, the early disciples, the great Shravakas do not know the meaning of the Tathagata's unsurpassed Bodhi, full awakening. Only the bodhisattvas who are not involved in calculations, meaning don't have a concept of, you know, making progress and, you know, going from ignorance to awakening and samsara to nirvana, only the bodhisattvas who are not involved in calculations gain advantage, meaning can understand the meaning. Only the bodhisattvas gain advantage and let go of advantage. Although it is like this, today I, Dogen, say on behalf of Indra, do you want a tree without roots? The cypress tree in the garden is that tree. And if you can't use that, then raise up your staff and say, this is exactly it. Do you want land without north and south? It's the charnel ground. And if you can't use that, use the entire world. Do you want a valley where shouts don't echo? Then shout out, sisters, to the seven wise women. And if the women respond, say to them, I have given you a valley without echoes. And if they don't respond, just tell them, well, forget about echoes anyway. So the whole world is a charnel ground, isn't it? And everything is always blooming. Whether we know it or not, each one of us has been given exactly what we need for this lifetime. We don't need anything else. The feeling you have right now won't last. And yet it will always be with you. So thank you all very much for listening to my Dharma talk this morning and for your practice. It is very inspiring and it's been wonderful to speak with many of you and hear about what you're doing. So take care. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Visions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Karma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.